This is Discovery 1, Module 7, which is all about wireless technologies. Okay, so after completing this lecture, you should be able to describe wireless technologies, describe the various components and structure of a wireless LAN, describe wireless security issues and mitigation strategies, configure and integrate a wireless access point and wireless client. Okay, so wireless technologies and devices. In addition to the wired networks, various wireless technologies exist allowing information to be transmitted without cables. Wireless technologies use electromagnetic waves to carry information between devices, which is the same medium as carrying radio signals through there. Okay, so this spectrum includes things like radio and television broadcast bands, X-rays and gamma rays, each of which have a specific range and wavelength associated. Okay, so some of the electromagnetic waves are suitable for carrying data while some aren't. And certain areas of the spectrum have been set aside to allow public use without restriction or having to apply for special permits. Most common wavelengths is used for public wireless communications, including the infrared and part of the radio frequency band. Okay, so infrared. Infrared has a relatively low energy and can't penetrate through walls or other obstacles. It's generally used for short-range line-of-sight communications on devices such as remote controls, wireless mice and keyboards, and data transfer between PDAs and PCs. To get the wireless, the infrared connection, it uses a specialized communications port known as an infrared direct access port to exchange information. It is only possible to have a one-to-one type of infrared connection, and it's possible to reflect infrared signals off objects to extend the range. Okay, so RF. Okay, so RF waves can penetrate through walls and obstacles, allowing a much greater range than infrared. Certain areas of the RF bands have been set aside for use by unlicensed devices such as wireless LANs, cordless phones, computer peripherals. Okay, the 900 MHz, 2.4 GHz and 5 GHz frequency are known as industrial, scientific and medical ISM bands and can be used with very little or no restrictions. Okay, and a specific type being Bluetooth. Uses the 2.4 GHz band to communicate, limited to low-speed, short-range communications, has the advantage of being able to communicate with multiple devices at the same time, which makes it superior to infrared because infrared is only one-to-one. Okay, and devices that use Bluetooth are mobile phones, printers, headsets, and mice and keyboards. Okay, so several other devices that make use of the 2.4 and 5 GHz bands being wireless LAN technologies. These devices transmit at a higher power level, giving them greater range. Okay, so wireless technologies. Okay. The benefits of wireless technologies: the ability to provide any time, anywhere connectivity. This allows people to download information, exchange emails and files. Okay, Wireless technology is easy and inexpensive to install. As the devices continue to increase, the capabilities are continually increasing, allowing faster, more reliable wireless connections. Okay, wireless technologies enable networks to be easily expanded without the limitation of cabled connections, and new and visiting users can join the network a lot easier than with wired technology. Okay, so limitations. Interference is a major limitation with the wireless LAN. So wireless LANs make use of unlicensed regions of the RF spectrum. Since these regions are unregulated, many different devices make use of them, like microwaves and cordless phones and such. As a result, the regions are congested and signals from different devices often interfere with each other. Okay, and now from a security perspective, wireless provides ease of access by broadcasting data in a manner that allows anyone to access it. And you can see why that would be a security risk, because everyone can access it, so therefore, you know, you're not limited to someone actually having to connect via a wire to your network. To address these concerns, technologies such as encryption and authentication have been developed to help secure wireless transmission. Okay, so the different types of wireless network.
Does anyone have any questions so far?
No.
Jolly good.
Okay, wireless networks are grouped into three major categories. You have WPAN, which is wireless personal area networks. These are the smallest of the wireless networks. They're used to connect various peripherals such as mice, keyboards, and PDAs. All devices are dedicated to a single host. Usually use infrared or Bluetooth technology for communication. Okay, next we have the wireless local area network. Okay, is typically used to extend the boundaries of local wired networks. Okay, wireless local area networks use radio frequency technology for transmission and conform to the IEEE 802.11 standards, and they allow many users to connect to a wired network through devices known as access points. Okay, and the third one is WWAN, which is wireless wide area networks, which provide coverage over extremely large areas. As an example, the cell phone network uses technology like CDMA and GSM for connectivity. Okay, so has anyone got any questions on any of that yet?
I guess if they do, they can always type something into chat.
Yeah, that's true. Did you have anything to add to that bit, Kerry, at all? Or?
No, that's all good.
Okay, so wireless LAN standards. Okay, there have been a number of standards that have been developed to allow devices to communicate and specify the RF spectrum data rates and how information is transmitted. The IEEE is an organization which is responsible for creating these wireless standards that control the wireless local area networks. You have four main standards, being 802.11a, 802.11b, G, and N. And a bit of a breakdown in each one. So 802.11a was the first one, obviously. Operates on a 5 GHz spectrum and has a maximum data rate of 54 megabits a second and a range of about 50 meters. 802.11b, operates on the 2.4 GHz spectrum, and has a maximum data rate of 11 megabits, and a maximum range of 100 meters. Okay, 802.11g operates on the 2.4 GHz spectrum also, has a maximum data rate of 54 megabits and a range of 100 meters. And 802.11n operates on the 2.4 GHz spectrum, or the 5 GHz spectrum, and has a maximum data rate of 540 megabits, and a maximum range of 250 meters. Now, most of the new access points that are actually available allow you to communicate in a thing called mixed mode, which means that you can use 802.11 B, G, or N, depending on your devices that are on your wireless network.
The difference between 11B and 11G is that B, as Josh said, is 11 megabits per second maximum data rate, and G is 54 megabits per second. G uses a different sort of modulation to B. Without going into too many details, it manages to pack more bits into each carrier transition. So that's how they use OFDM modulation, I think. I'd have to actually Wikipedia it up. But it does allow for a higher payload to go through on the same bandwidth. They use the same channel setup, but it is a more complex form of modulation.
All right, cool. Thanks for that, Gary.
You've got your text-to-speech on, do you, Josh? Can you hear what's coming through the chat?
Yeah, I got that question as well.
Cool.
Okay, so components of the wireless local area network. Once a new standard is adopted, it's important that all components within the wireless LAN adhere to the standard. Components being the client, access point, antennas, and wireless bridges. Okay, now, wireless antennas are used on both access points and bridges. They increase the output signal, known as gain. Antennas are classified according to the way they radiate their signal, and you have two different types. You have directional, which send a signal in one direction, and you have omnidirectional, which send a signal equally in all directions. Okay, and generally, for most of your home networking use, you probably only need, like, you know, your general one that comes with your modem, because you don't have to transmit data long distances. Once you start getting out into the business environment and so forth, data has to go further, and therefore you want to get an antenna that amplifies the signal. The only other thing that you need to watch out for with this is that you know, you don't get a signal that's generated too far, otherwise you'll be generating your signal outside of the building range or company range that needs to be, and this makes your network susceptible to attackers.
In Australia, and I think in most places in the world, there is actually a limit on the legal amount of power that you're allowed to radiate. I think it's 4 watts TDP. I'd have to check. But there is actually a legal limit in Australia as to how much wireless power you can throw out, and if you're throwing out more than that, you can actually be fined. So it's something to be aware of. It's probably not with the regular antennas that you're going to buy you'll ever have that problem, but if you are looking at putting together things like parabolic grid packs and stuff, it is possible to exceed the power regulations, and that's not usually a good idea.
I think if you were just wanting to, like, extend your range like a small bit, say your 5 dB GaN antenna would extend it. How far do you think, Kerry?
Maybe, and it depends on the building material. I mean, most of the time with wireless networks, it's a brick wall that's stopping the signal. So, but you might get another 10, 20, 30 meters out if you put, you know, 5 dBi or 7 dBi antennas on. It will extend it to a degree, but often relocating the access point and putting it up higher will do more for you than actually the aerial. But it, I mean, the aerial is another thing you can also do if you if you're just on the edge of reception range. You've got the laptop that's just that little bit too far away.
Yeah, because I know over here a lot of our buildings are done with double brick, or houses are done with double brick, and that makes it pretty bad for wireless technology.
Yeah, for reasons that I'm not clear on, N does a far better job on that these days, we've discovered. And the ultra-wop Ns, which you can get from FreeNet antennas, they work really well in those sorts of environments. So I don't know what they do different, but yeah, I've read stories about them working where other things don't. So, interesting.
You could test that one out.
Yeah, I could bring one in at some point.
Okay, now we'll start talking about the actual access points and things like that. So, wireless LANs and the SSID. When connecting to a wireless access point, it is important to get the correct SSID, which is known as also service set identifier. Characteristics. Okay. Case sensitive alphanumeric string. So numbers and letters in the string. They are generally 32 characters long, and sent in all headers, and sent in the headers, sorry, of all frames on the wireless local area network. And they tell devices which LAN they belong to and which other devices they can communicate with. Alright, so I know there's not really a standard on setting your like SSIDs and so forth and so on, but you know you want to make it, I suppose, specific to your network. Like, there's no point in calling it 1 or 6 or 7 or 10 or whatever. You may as well make it like, you know, I don't know. For instance, we could have one called Cavi or something like that. And that would be specific to that network.
Actually, to be honest, the first time I set up a wireless network, I spent an entire afternoon figuring out why it wouldn't work. And at about 7 o'clock in the evening, I actually discovered that I didn't have the SSID set the same on the wireless card as I did on the access point. So, in defense of me, this was back in 2003 when wireless was all a bit new, but yeah, it really is important to get those SSIDs the same, and especially if you've got a hidden SSID, which Josh will talk about later in the lecture, you'd better know what it is if you're going to hide it.
Okay, so, forms of wireless networks, okay? You have two, ad hoc and infrastructure, okay? So, ad hoc networks. Connect two or more wireless clients together in a peer-to-peer network. Okay, all clients are equal. There's no access point required, so therefore saving you the money of that. And the area covered by the ad hoc is known as the independent basic service set. Okay, so pretty much like if you wanted to connect two computers together or so forth, it's a good idea to use ad hoc rather than having to go and get an access point. And like I said before, they do connect in a peer-to-peer network, so yeah. Okay, infrastructure. Okay, use device to control communications in the wireless cell. This is like your access point. Okay, so the access point says who can talk and when they can talk. The area covered is known as the basic service set, so BSS, which you should remember because I'm going to talk a bit more about that a bit later. Okay. Okay. So now extending BSSs. All right. So the BSSs use one access point to communicate. Sometimes it's necessary to extend the coverage of a network. So to do this, multiple BSSs are connected together and form an ESS, which extended service set. Okay. On the extended service set, like I was saying, you have multiple BSSs, so what the notes state is that you should have about a 10% overlap between all of your BSSs, so that you're able to connect to the second BSS before you disconnect from the first. So does that make sense to everyone? Okay, next we'll talk about channels. Channels are created by dividing up the available radio frequency spectrum. Each channel is capable of carrying different communications. Multiple access points can function in close proximity to one another using different channels. Okay, so like for instance, if I had a wireless access point and there was one just down the road, as long as they're operating in different channels, they shouldn't. Okay.
You don't have to disconnect from one to connect to the other. The roaming should happen automatically. So what happens is you create a wireless network with four wireless access points, all set with the ESS ID of Cavi or whatever, and the software on your computer, the zero configuration wireless for Windows or the manufacturer software, will automatically roam to the other access point transparently without disconnecting once the signal drops below a certain level. And if you look at things like the Atheros client utilities, you can actually set the roaming threshold, which is all a bit advanced, but you can actually do it and say, I want you to drop when the signal goes below 20% instead of 10%.
So pretty much it's useful for extending the distance of your...
Just curious, are any of you guys on the Cavi mailing lists, or that's not something you guys subscribe to? All right, well, if anybody... Seriously, I mean, I'm sure Josh will answer most of your questions, but if you have any questions, do feel free to post on the mailing list. We're all pretty nice, and we'll do our best to answer them.
Okay, so back to the channels. So occasionally it is possible for the frequencies to overlap. Okay, so just keep that in mind, and if you want to, you can either set your channels manually or have them set automatically by the access point.
It's probably worth mentioning that the actual channels, the only channels that don't overlap are 1, 5, 10 and 14, so channels 1 and 2 overlap, channels 1 and 4 overlap, but because of the spread spectrum, that's not a critical problem. You will get a little bit of interference if you're within a channel that's near, say if you're on channel 3 and somebody else is on channel 1, but that'll usually show up as noise. So yeah, 1, 5, 10 and 14 are the channels that don't overlap.
During your wireless access point, the following should be identified.
There's a list. List of 802.11 wireless channels into Google will get you a list. They're actually frequency bands. So yeah, just Google that up and we'll give you one. Otherwise, there's probably a list of them on Wikipedia. At least that's how I'd find them anyway.
Okay, so like I was saying, so you need to identify the standard used, the layout used, and the channel assignment must be known. Okay. Now, most of the integrated service routers now offer wired and wireless connectivity. Basically, have the same common settings for wireless and wired, being the passwords, IP addresses, and DHCP. They're all common. Now, when you're playing with the wireless access points, one of the biggest security things that you can sort of have on there is not setting the administrator password for your wireless access point. When you first get your wireless access points, they do come with a standard password and standard IP address. So if you don't configure those, anyone can just what the password is, access your wireless access point and modify it or hijack it to their own needs. So they're a good idea to set that. Okay, and also, like, when you're configuring the wireless access point, it's good to sort of really have a good think about the way you want to structure your network, what IP address you want to use, all these settings, like whether you want to have applied to your network or something like that, and also like if you want to have certain devices on your network, for instance, like a server or so forth. So configuring the client side, the host obviously is any device that contains a wireless network interface card, and so the software used allows hosts to utilize the available hardware and comes in two forms. You have the operating system integrated software, so it's like built into Windows or Mac OS. It has some really, really basic features that allow you to connect to the wireless network. And you can also get standalone software, which is downloadable software that basically gives you a better like a better usage, I suppose. Has a lot more functionality, like allows you to have profiles, link information and site survey. The one that comes with Windows is okay. Have you ever had any problems with that at all, Kerry?
No, it's actually fairly accessible, all things considered. If you're running SP2 and you don't apply the hotfixes, you can't connect to WPA2 networks, so you need to be at least running Windows XP Service Pack 3 to connect to WPA2 networks, although the one in Vista and Windows 7 seems pretty good. It's pretty low-featured, but it does work well and it is quite accessible, so I tend to recommend that people use that over the manufacturer utilities, unless the manufacturer utilities are accessible, such as the Intel or Theros ones. Whereas the ones for Linksys and Netgear and stuff are quite inaccessible, so they're not very cool for blind people.
Okay, now, like Kerry was saying before, with his wireless SSID matching thing, it's imperative that to communicate with any access points on the network, all of your information must match. So that's going to be the first thing you got to check if your wireless connection isn't working. You got the right SSID, you got the right key to get into your network, that you don't have a static IP or something like that, and you can't actually see the router, so forth. Okay, once the both devices are configured, make sure you check the connectivity on the host and the between the host and the access point. You can do that with the software. Usually it will have like a signal strength is a good one, showing you between 1 and say 5 bars of strength, 1 being very low and 5 being very high. You can also ping the device, make sure it's working there, and if you've got an access point with an integrated internet service, you can try and get out onto the internet. Make sure that's working as well. Okay, so next we have security considerations. Okay, on a wireless network, information is transferred through the air, which makes the network vulnerable to hackers. Okay, once access is gained, hackers can use the internet and access data or computers on your network. Okay, so basic options to protect against malicious unwanted hackers you can use are, firstly, turning off your SSID. Okay, so when you first get your router and you set it up, you can connect all of your hosts to it. They'll generally see a little pop-up with the SSID in it, and you can just connect to that. Change the default ISR settings. So like I was saying before, don't leave the standard SSID, don't leave the standard administrator password, and enable MAC filtering, which means that your host can only connect to your wireless router using if their MAC address is known by the access point. Now I've in the past, I've noticed that with the SSID, turning the SSID off, if you configure your network, set the leave the SSID on, connect to your network, save the settings, and then turn the SSID off, it should see the network because it knows what it's looking for. That's a good way to get around your like putting in the wrong SSID. Have you found that works as well, Kerry?
What, the hiding the SSIDs and stuff?
So, like I'm saying, if you put your SSID so you don't turn it off, connect one of the hosts or all of your hosts to your network, save the settings like, you know, your password, your SSID, whatever, and then turn the SSID off.
Yeah, that does work well. one of the problems I had with having an... we used to have our network at Cavi Invisible, and every time all the users used to walk in, they used to go, "Can't see any wireless networks, I can't see any wireless networks." So we actually gave up on hiding the SSID because people are just so used to seeing them pop up in the interface. So if you can deal with the SSID being hidden, and you would like to hide it, it's a good thing to do. But do also keep in mind that as soon as a device communicates with your wireless access point, it is possible to sniff the network externally. So it adds a small amount of security. It's up to the user to decide whether that level of security is warranted.
All right. So, yeah, like, that brings me to my next point, is, yeah, even with the SSID hidden, it's still possible to connect as the SSID is sent in plain text.
No, it doesn't. MAC filtering just allows devices with certain MAC addresses to communicate with the access point, so provided all of the MAC addresses on your local devices are added in, you won't have a problem, and MAC addresses are only relevant on the local network segment. It's, I'm handing it back to you, Josh. There you go.
Okay, so the authentication, if enabled, if authentication is enabled, credentials are required before clients are allowed to connect to the wireless LAN. You have three types of connection. The first one is open, which means that there is no authentication. As long as if you have your SSID shown up, you click on the SSID or go to the SSID and you can connect straight into the network from there. Okay. So are we going to say something, Kerry?
Sorry, I'm in an MSN window where my hotkey doesn't work. Sorry, I missed that. I'm leaving it to you at the moment.
All right, cool. Yeah, that's all right. Okay, so PSK. Both the access point and client must be configured with the same key. Access point sends the random string of bytes to the client. The client encrypts the string and sends it back to the access point. Sorry, what was that?
I don't think anybody said anything, did they?
Okay. I was saying the client encrypts the string and sends it back. The access point gets the encrypted string and uses the key to decrypt it. If the decrypted string from the client matches the original string, the client is allowed to connect to the network. And PSK performs one-way authentication, which is host to access point. Okay. And next we have EAP, which provides mutual two-way authentication. When software is installed on the client communicates with back-end authentication server, such as RADIUS, which stands for Remote Authentication Dial-In User Server. A RADIUS server is separate to the access point and maintains a database of valid users that can connect to that particular machine. Okay, so encryption. Authentication and MAC filtering may stop an attacker from connecting, but it will not prevent them from being able to intercept data. Encryption is used, so even if the hacker interprets, intercepts the data, they can't use it at all. Okay, there are two main methods, WEP and WPA. Okay, WEP standing for Wireless Equivalency Protocol. WEP encrypts network traffic as it travels through the air, uses a pre-configured key to encrypt and decrypt the data. The key is entered as an alphanumeric string, so numbers and letters, and is generally between 64 and 128 bits. In order for WEP to function, the access point and device must have the same WEP key. A major weakness of WEP is that it has a static key. Which makes it easier for devices to get hold of. And a really, really good way of fixing this problem is to change a key every once in a while, so therefore sort of making it dynamic, I guess.
It's also a right pain in the backside to change your key every once in a while. It's probably a good idea, but then you've got to go on through and change the key on your wireless router and every wireless device you've got. So it's a good idea from a security standpoint. It's just not a lot of fun.
Okay, so that brings me to the next one, which is WPA, which is Wildfire Protected Access. Uses a 64-bit to 256-bit long key. Generates a new dynamic key each time a client establishes a connection with the access point. And WPA is considered obviously more secure because it's significantly more difficult to crack. So, like I was saying before, use a dynamic key, so bigger advantage over over WEP. Okay, now, traffic filtering. The majority of access points you can get now, if not all access points, you can generally filter the traffic that that comes in and goes out of your network. Okay, sometimes good to control the traffic going through the network. Filtering blocks undesirable traffic from entering or leaving the wireless network. It can remove from traffic coming from or traffic going to a MAC or IP address on your network, so you can block it based on that stuff, so the client's MAC or IP address. It can block applications. It can block by port numbers. So, for instance, you could block all Telnet services on your router or all HTTP services on your router. And I'm pretty sure the list you can filter all the way down to block, say, for instance, user A, which has IP address, say, 192.168.1.1 from accessing any HTTP services on your network. So it's like a, like combination of the different techniques available. And by doing this, more of the network is available to important traffic. So getting rid of all unwanted traffic, your traffic that you do want is communicate and get onto the network a lot better. Okay, planning the wireless LAN. Before implementing the wireless LAN, is it important to determine the type of wireless standard to use? Determine the most efficient layout of the devices. Build a site survey to determine placement of devices. Determine a strategy for backing up and updating the firmware of the router. Some key factors to consider when determining the standard: bandwidth requirements, coverage area, existing implementation, and cost. Okay, say you work for a small company that they don't have a lot of traffic. Maybe there's 10 people in your office. Okay, so in this case, the bandwidth shouldn't matter that much, because if you've only got a couple of people in the office, then bandwidth shouldn't be a problem. Requirements. You might have, say 10 people or so, but those 10 people may need to access applications which are stored on a server, or access a lot of data which is stored on a server. If they're constantly downloading and uploading information to the server, that's when your bandwidth starts becoming a problem, and it comes under requirements because the staff need to be able to do it. And it's a requirement that your network operates, say, at 802.11n or something like that. Your coverage area, like I was saying before, maybe you might work in an office that the wireless signal doesn't extend all the way to, so you need to get like an antenna to amplify the signal strength. And that's when you need to also decide, well, do you want to have a single directional antenna or an omnidirectional antenna to provide your signal. Have a look at your existing implementations. If you've already got a server installed and things like that, you've already got your switches and so forth, all the access point that you're going to get is going to do is just plug into the already existing network. It could be go both ways, I guess, to say, do I get an access point that, you know, only has a switch, or an integrated services device that only has a switch that does, you know, 100 megabit Ethernet, or it does gigabit Ethernet. Be good to have gigabit because, you know, it might be good for future expansion, but if your current system only runs at 100 megabit, then you're only going to go as fast as the current technology allows. Okay, and cost. Unless you're working for a big company, a lot of the smaller ones tend to use a lot cheaper gear rather than the more expensive gear that does pretty much everything. Okay, so questions to ask yourself before determining standards. What throughput is actually required to apply in the network? How many users will use the network, like I was saying before? What is the necessary coverage area? What is the existing network status? And what is the best way to determine user requirements? Okay, and placement installation. This is a pretty big area for your network installation. If you place the access point in the right spot, it will save you the cost of getting antennas. May save you the job of moving it later on when you determine it's not in the right spot, and you know only half your clients can connect to it. Okay. After you have placed the access point, you need to configure it. Okay, and like I said earlier, as soon as you configure the access point, you should change the default password or administrator password so that no one else can access your access point and modify your configuration. Possibly disable broadcast SSID, and possibly use MAC filtering to filter the people that can connect to your network. One thing with using MAC filtering though is if you do get guests or people that need to connect to your network temporarily, you'll have to go jump onto the access point to allow them access to it each time they want to connect or have that MAC address in the table. So say you get a person who only wants to come to your building once and wants to use the wireless access for 10 minutes. That 10 minutes of their access, you probably spend 5 minutes going on there and adding the MAC address to the table and then getting rid of it once they go. Okay, you can also use some of the more advanced security measures, configuring encryption using WEP or WPA. You can configure authentication So usernames and passwords, so forth, to connect to your system, and configure traffic filtering. Kerry, do you know whether you can filter the traffic based on a user if you use a Radius server?
Oh, my word, yes, Chanel. You certainly can. And in fact, that is the best way to block. You can actually have usernames and passwords, and you can actually say which users are permitted and which users are not permitted.
Cool, because yeah, I've never set up a Radius server, so I don't know how they work.
The UltraWAPs actually have an inbuilt Radius server, so if I get motivated, I'll bring one in and you can have a look. You can set up to 256 users without having to set up the whole back end, which tends to be a bit complex, so we'll see if we can do that at some point.
Alright, yeah, that'd be cool. Okay, now, one thing you have to remember with anything wireless networking based, nothing is 100% secure. No matter what security you put in, if someone wants to get through it badly enough, they will. And, you know, although, you know, we've gone through about 20 minutes or so of going through wireless security techniques and so forth and so on, there are courses that go for, you know, weeks and months and so forth on wireless security and how you can implement it and improve it and so forth and so on. So we've only just touched the surface of the wireless security. Okay, so backups. Once the network is properly configured, a full configuration backup should be performed. Sometimes it's necessary to restore the factory defaults on your router if stuff tends to go badly. If you have a backup configuration file, this will probably save you a lot of time, as you don't have to keep, like, change all your LAN settings and DNS settings, whatever. Okay, and lastly, firmware upgrades. On an access point, the operating system is stored in the firmware. This firmware should be upgraded to get new features only available, on the more recent firmware updates. It's also a good idea to get it to get rid of certain bugs that might be in the current firmware version. So, look at upgrading that. I don't know, what's a good time period to upgrade it, Kerry?
Sorry, I missed the question.
Good time to upgrade firmware, every 6 months or so, you think?
I'm sort of the opinion that if it ain't broke, don't fix it. If you've got a problem on your network or you think that there might be, I'd probably check every 3 or 6 months and read the change logs, because sometimes with some devices, upgrading the firmware will trash all of the settings, and if the configuration files change between the firmware versions, you can't just restore the configuration file. You've got to re-enter your settings. So I'd have a look at the change logs, see if it's something worthwhile that you want to upgrade, and then put the new firmware into it, on an as-needs basis. But, I mean, other people may have different ideas as to... Some people like having the latest firmware, and, you know, it's certainly up to them if they want to do that.
But I didn't realise about the, different... configuration file systems. So, okay. So steps to update the firmware. Determine the current version of the firmware on the access point. Search the manufacturer's website for updates. Download the updated version of the firmware and store on a machine directly connected to the access point. Select the firmware upgrade feature in the access point graphical user interface. Browse for the file on the local computer where you downloaded it to, and start the upgrade. Okay, one important thing you need to know about when you're upgrading the firmware is once it starts installing the firmware, it's important that it doesn't get disturbed. If it is interrupted, sometimes the device may be, deemed unusable.
Which is also referred to bricking a device, and that is actually in Wikipedia. If you brick a device, you cause a device to be unusable, and it basically serves the same purpose as a brick. Keep your door open, etc. Yes, it does. The network definitely becomes unavailable during a firmware upgrade.
So you can pretty much think about a firmware upgrade as the same sort of thing, I guess, reformatting your computer. So reinstalling Windows. Okay, and that brings us to the end of the wireless networking lecture. So thanks heaps for listening, and that's it.
Anyone got any questions before I hit the stop button? All right, I'll take that as a no. Well done, Josh. I will post-process and push this up in about half an hour to an hour or so.
All right, cool. Have a bit of a listen. All right, thank you very much for your help, Kerry. I really appreciate it.
No worries.
All right, guys, well, you enjoy the rest of your week, and I will see you guys next week.
No worries.
Thank you, Mr. Ghost, and thank you, Kerry. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, see you guys.
Thank you, both of you.